a particular act. You know, for example, if we do we have a kind thought, we see a hungry animal, and so with a good thought we give some food, the immediate result is that the animal's hunger is satisfied. But the very energy of that good thought remains after we've given some food. It creates an impression upon our mind, and that impression is called a karmic potency or an imprint. A potency has the meaning of, it has the potential to bring about a future effect. So every action we do creates this potency on our mind stream, which remains like a seed, until at some time in the future, when conditions are suitable, and we'll talk about those, that potential brings about a change in our mind. It brings about a mental intention that connects the mind with another experience. In this example, a pleasant or a virtuous potential has the capacity to connect our mind with a pleasant experience. That's what we're going to be talking about this whole weekend in more detail. Unpleasant actions, of course, create a potency that can connect the mind sometime in the future with an unpleasant experience. So we are unaware that throughout our life, every pleasant experience, every unpleasant experience that we have ever had is a result not only of the external conditions, the pleasant objects, unpleasant objects that we happen to meet in life, but there is an internal cause of why our organism, our being, meets with these unpleasant circumstances or these pleasant circumstances. So this is an underlying reality that we're totally unaware of. When we talk about karma, in general, karma refers to a cause and effect process that's happening all the time, but which we're unaware of. And being unaware of that, it seems clear and logical to us that if I want to be happy, then I have to go and obtain the sources of happiness, that they all exist out there. And whether I experience that pleasant object, and whether I avoid experiencing an unpleasant object or situation, is totally up to my ability to control my environment and get the accumulation of money to buy what I want, and the being healthy and fit, etc., to avoid sickness and the things I don't want. So our lives are really organized around that belief that the root cause, the primary cause of pleasure and pain is external. But the teachings on karma indicate that the external sources of pleasure and pain are conditions, that an internal, the primary reason why we meet with pleasant situations or unpleasant situations is in our own mind. The accumulated karmic potentials from our past actions, not just of this life, but of past lives as well, that came with the mind from previous lives. All right. So it is such an important topic to understand karma, to really gain a clear understanding of the mechanism. And the notes I've given you are a sort of an outline from the graduated path teachings, and we will talk about those notes as well as more information. So, taking the subject of this weekend seminar seriously, every action we do depends upon our motivation, our purpose for doing the action, and the result depends upon the purpose. So if we have a positive, virtuous motivation or attitude, then the action we engage in will become beneficial. It will establish a positive karmic potential in our mind, and then the result will be much greater in terms of bringing pleasure. If we go into an action with a sort of half-hearted motivation, a half-hearted intention, or even, like, I don't know, some of you might be here unwillingly because your partner dragged you along to come to the Buddha's talk, then participating in the talk, I hope, will be beneficial. But the unwilling motivation will make it not so beneficial. Whereas your partner, who is very willing and has a strong understanding for being here, will create a much better karmic potential than you. So, fortunately, we may have come here with an unwilling motivation, but we can change it. And now's the time to be skillful in taking control of our own mind. Right? Because having control of our mind means having control of our life. Because of what I've explained, the underlying karmic potentials are the root cause of our experiences, and we're all equally want happiness, and we equally don't want suffering. And we all equally have every right to have happiness and every right to be protected from suffering. But until we heard about karma, we have tried to exert our right for happiness and freedom from suffering by controlling the world, controlling the environment, controlling society, controlling our family members, you know, all the external things which we believe will, if I get them in place, then I will be happy. But probably a few of us, if not all of us, have come to the realization that it hasn't really worked, that we can't actually control the external world. We can't actually ensure that if we throw a party tonight, we're going to be happy. A lot of things can go wrong at a party. And we spend a lot of money, put a lot of energy into trying to gather a group of friends and have a good time. But because we actually have no control over our friends' minds, we have no control over our own mind, it could be a disaster. So, we can continue until we die trying to organize the outside world to give happiness and avoid suffering. But that will exhaust us, and there in all of history, well, I believe, I don't know, but I think, no human being in the history of society in this world has ever achieved perfect happiness, freedom from suffering, by organizing others, organizing the outside world. But I do believe, and I believe that there are beings such as the Holiness of Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, our teachers, who have achieved total inner peace, despite things going wrong outside there. Nothing disturbs the inner peace of the mind through control of the mind. Okay, so to begin, we'll just do take a short time to meditate on the coming and going of our breath, to make our mind still and quiet, and then generate a pure motivation to engage in this action of the seminar today of listening to Dharma, thinking about Dharma, and discussing Dharma. Okay, so sit comfortably and keep your back straight, eyes lightly closed or slightly open, and focus your whole attention on the coming and going of your breath at the nostrils, the sensation of the air as it enters and leaves the nostrils with each breath, and try to avoid distracted thoughts taking your attention away from the breath. Now I think I'm going to establish my mind in a pure motivation, a pure purpose for participating in this seminar on karma this weekend. First, reflect upon the qualities of the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. and generate the aspiration to understand the Dharma as taught by the Buddha, to know in more detail the teachings, in particular on karma. And then think that it's not just for my own benefit that I want to understand karma, but by understanding karma, I can take control of my mind and train my mind on the path to its full potential of enlightenment, of Buddhahood. So that in my own right, I can become a perfect guide to lead all other beings out of the suffering wheel of life based upon ignorance and karmic actions. Then you can relax and stop the meditation. So now, during the weekend, during the talks, I like very much to receive questions. Don't hesitate to, if there's something you're not clear about, you can put your hand up and ask a question, and we can develop the discussion in terms of a discussion, not a formal lecture. Don't feel that everybody else knows what he's talking about. If I ask, I'll look stupid. You won't, because we all have the same questions. And the only way to really learn is to ask questions. Now, in my previous weekend seminars, we've talked about the mind, and we've talked about the process of death and rebirth. And so I think to enter into this discussion on karma, it's good to just revise very quickly some of the points that have come up in the past weekend seminars. Clearly, from what I've said already, when we're talking about karma, we're talking about our own mind, and we must have clear understanding of what our mind is and how it functions. So, you remember, in Buddhism, every term that we use needs to be defined. We need to have a clear idea of the meaning of the terms, definition. If we don't, if what I mean when I talk about mind is different from what you understand by the term mind, then there's a barrier to communication. So from the outset, it's important to follow the line of logic and clear understanding to have the terms that I'm going to use clearly defined and understood. So in Buddhism, the definition of mind is the continuum of mere clarity and awareness. So those defining characteristics need to be explained. First of all, a continuum. Our mind is the continuity from past to present to future of moments of awareness or subjective experience of the outer world through our five senses and the inner world of thoughts, knowledge, memories, ideas, and so on through what in Buddhism we call the mental consciousness. So the mental consciousness is our sixth sense, if you like. We have eye consciousness, ear consciousness, smell, taste, touch consciousness, the five sensory awarenesses, which are aware of the sensory world. And then the sixth type of awareness we call mental consciousness. So this is the realm of our accumulated knowledge, our memories, our emotions, constructive emotions of generosity, kindness, love, compassion, and destructive emotions, selfishness, anger, jealousy, pride, and so on. So we all have these various emotions, either manifest or non-manifest at any one moment in time. And we know that how happiness, unhappiness, also are mental experiences. So when we talk about mind being a continuum, there is this unbroken continuum of primary awareness of the sensory world and our mental consciousness, and then the secondary factors which influence our awareness. Like when we see something pleasant, there is pleasure manifest, you know, the feeling of happiness manifesting in the eye consciousness. When we see something unpleasant, there's a feeling of unhappiness or displeasure in what the eye consciousness is experiencing. So actually every moment of consciousness has one of the three types of feeling: pleasure, displeasure, or neutral feeling. And these fluctuate as we go through our life and we contact different things. Some are pleasant, some are unpleasant. And then there are associated emotions. When we experience something unpleasant, there is aversion, like dislike. Don't like that. And that dislike can then become the anger, which is pushing away, wanting to separate from that unpleasant situation, or even more fierce types of anger, like hatred and aggression, and so on. So these destructive emotions arise with unhappy feeling and so on. Then that can pass, and with time we can contact something pleasant. So pleasure arises in the mind, and attraction. Oh, I want that. I don't want to be separated from that. That's nice. So with every pleasant feeling, our mind automatically generates clinging to the object of pleasure, not wanting to be separated. So we have attachment or clinging. And that is also a destructive emotion, because even though there's nothing wrong with pleasure, happy feeling, clinging to the object of happiness is an agitation in the mind. It is not wanting to separate or wanting to possess the object of pleasure. And that sort of craving to not be separated, that is an agitated mind. We don't have to have that. We have anger and we have attachment because of the more fundamental ignorance about how we exist as an individual and how the objects of pleasure and objects of pain exist. And through that confusion in how things actually exist, our mind concretizes our world into good, bad, I want, I don't want. And the dominant entity is me. This sort of preoccupation with me, my needs, that is the root of all our problems. And we will come to that, the solution to that root, probably during this weekend. So, this is just in explaining what mind is, we're talking about the continuum, right? So the continuum, and this continuum is uninterrupted 24 hours a day. Even when we go to sleep, although our gross sense consciousnesses stop functioning, mostly, not entirely, but mostly, our sixth sense, our mental consciousness, keeps going in a more subtle way, and that manifests as dreams. So the dream world, all of the events, the experiences, the feelings in a dream are all occurring in mental consciousness. And then there are times when we're asleep and there's no overt dreaming, but still there is subtle awareness, even like it's ongoing darkness. Mental consciousness is still functioning, even in deep sleep. It never stops entirely. Even when we die, mental consciousness is still functioning right up to the point of death. And within the consciousness, there is retained all of the seeds of our emotions. Like, you know, we're in deep sleep. Obviously, there's no constructive emotion, there's no destructive emotion manifesting. That the mind is neutral, you know, the feeling is neutral. But even while still asleep, when we start dreaming, then desire can manifest, aversion, anger can manifest. We can sometimes do terrible things out of anger in a dream. Of course, this is purely the mental imagery and the act, but still, attachment or anger in a dream are an indication that we have the imprints of those emotions, and when we wake up, then whatever happens during the day, the imprints of anger, the imprints of attachment can manifest under certain conditions. So the fact that they can be suppressed during sleep does not mean that we have solved them, that the imprints are there. So that's the first defining characteristic of mind, a continuum of awareness, is going from moment to moment throughout life. Second, clarity, this term clarity. In a very broad sense, consciousness or mind, they are synonyms, is clear in that subjective experience or awareness or mind is not a physical phenomenon. It doesn't have color, it doesn't have shape, you can't measure it in any way. It doesn't have any physical characteristics. This is very difficult for the materialistic scientific mind to accept. Scientifically, we see the brain and the electrochemical activity within the brain as being mind, awareness. They can't be, according to scientifically thinking, there can't be something which is totally non-physical, which is mind, and then the body. This creates a duality of physical body and non-physical mind. So there seems to be no way that something which is non-physical can in any way interact with our brain, our nervous system, our body. So a non-physical mind is dismissed from the materialistic view of science. There is an interaction between body and mind, which we will come to, a very important interaction, that capacity for non-physical mind to interact with the body. And this is the main topic of this morning's talk, maybe after lunch as well. So we're talking about the second defining characteristic of mind, clarity. In a very general sense, it means mind is non-physical. In particular, clarity refers to the fact that whenever we're aware of something, whenever we experience something, our mind takes the appearance or takes the aspect of that which we are aware. For example, if our eyes see the blue sky, then the eye consciousness is aware of the colour blue. Mostly, it's not cloudy. We look up, we see the colour blue. So that experience, that subjective experience of the colour blue, if we really check up, where is it? It exists, like we all know what it's like, unless we're colorblind, but we all know what it's like to experience the color blue. But that actual color blue, if we really check up, the electromagnetic rays, which are of the suitable frequency to initiate the experience of blue, those rays are not the colour blue. They're a physical phenomenon, an electromagnetic phenomenon, but they in themselves are not blue. So when those rays strike the retina, then a chemical change occurs, an electrical signal goes to the visual part of the brain. Again, the electrical signal is not the colour blue. That results in change in the optical region of the brain, which is at the back somewhere. And there is the mental experience of blue. But the chemical change is not blue. You see, but there is awareness of what we all agree. Actually, when we were little babies, we had no idea that this experience was blue. It was only when we began to learn to talk that we could associate the term blue with the experience of the clear sky. So you see, clarity, taking the aspect of the object, is a mental phenomenon. It is a defining characteristic of mind. When our mind experiences blue, that is a definite, that's the meaning of clarity. Our mind is taking the aspect or the appearance of blue. Do you understand? It's a little bit subtle, but we can apply that to all of our senses. Also, we can apply it to our mental consciousness, right? So our sixth sense. Like we can close our eyes and think of blue sky. And there it appears to our mental consciousness, because thinking is an activity of mental consciousness, not eye consciousness. So when we think of something, there is an image of that object we're thinking about appears to our thought. We call that a mental image. In this situation, the color blue is appearing to the mental consciousness as this mental image of blue. So the thought consciousness, aware of the idea of blue, is taking the aspect as a mental image of blue. But it's not blue. It's suitable to be called blue, but it's a mental image. Okay. So clarity. Taking the aspect of the object. This is a purely psychological phenomenon, a mental phenomenon. Yes, a camera can record the electromagnetic waves and then reproduce them as what we all say are the color blue. But there's a difference between the subjective experience of blue, because the third defining characteristic of mind, which occurs simultaneously with the clarity, is awareness, right? Remember the three definition of mind, the continuum of clarity and awareness. Awareness is knowing, the quality of cognitive engagement in the object. So when the eyes observe the blue sky, that information, always the sensory information, is being relayed to the sixth sense of mental consciousness. And it is mental consciousness which knows that that experience is suitable to be called blue. And we may know a lot about blue scientifically. We know that that's at one end of the spectrum, the visual spectrum, the short wavelengths. We may know what shade of blue it is, and so on. We may even know why the sky looks blue, because of the way the atmosphere interferes with the sunlight. And so the electromagnetic radiation suitable to be called blue appears to our eyes. So we may have a whole lot of knowledge. So that is the awareness aspect of mind. Our senses know a lot of what is experiencing. Cameras don't know anything about what they're experiencing. Mirrors have clarity. A mirror can reflect any physical object that appears in front of it, which is a bit like the clarity of mind. But a mirror has no idea of what it is reflecting. Unless it's the mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the most attractive of them all? That must have been a special mirror. With mind. So, awareness is the third quality of mind. Okay. That is the general definition of mind. In a more subtle way, and this presentation comes from the more profound texts on meditation in Tantra and so on, the consciousness is never separated from subtle physical energy, what's called wind energy. In Sanskrit, the term prana. In Tibetan, it's called lung, which are both translated in English as wind, the most subtle form of matter. Chinese, I'm not sure, qi, that refers to wind. So, consciousness clearly occurs in dependence upon our physiological functioning of our body, our sense organs, our nervous system. In the tantric texts, there's a presentation of a subtle body composed of chakras and channels through which flow wind energies. And these wind energies are inseparable with mind, with consciousness. In fact, they are said to be one entity with two different functions. Now, one entity in general means the one thing, but that one thing has two functions. And one function of movement, like wind flows, so there's movement, that is labeled wind, physical, subtle physical, not as gross as atoms and molecules, but in physics we talk about a lot of subtle physical forms. We label that wind. Another function is awareness, and we label that mind. So you see, this is single entity, two functions, wind and mind, suitable to be labeled. I mean, this is just occurs to me now that we talk about a human being as being a single entity with many functions. So there's a particular human being, so if it is a male body, it can function as a male. If it's a female body, it can function as a female. And there are certain functions of males and females which are individual or unique to that gender. So suitably be called man, suitably be called woman, and then according to the educational experience, this person is suitably be called teacher, suitably be called doctor, lawyer, nurse, whatever. They can function as a carpenter or as a, you know, whatever career that they have learned, and or an elected situation, member of parliament, president, king, queen. These are different functions which different individuals can perform and which acquire, can be indicated by a name. So, coming back to this subtle wind flowing through the channels, it has the two functions. Movement, we call wind. Awareness, we call mind. Now, the tantric texts give a description of the chakras and channels, and the reason is to enable meditators, yogis and yoginis, to meditate on the different chakras, on the channels, you know, when you've had the instruction from qualified teacher. And an explanation of why one meditates and what happens as a result of meditating on these chakras and controlling the wind energies. So, since the time of Buddha, these meditations have been received by students and they've been practiced and the results have been achieved. The results, all the levels of the path up to enlightenment. So, therein is the proof of the validity of meditating on these channels and chakras. But also, if you go to a strange city, you've never been there before, then to find your way around, you buy a map, or you bring it up on your screen, you know, Google Maps. But whatever, this map enables you to get to where you want. But that map is not the city. It is an aid to getting where you want. So, at the time of Buddha, there wasn't the depth of anatomical knowledge that we have accumulated nowadays and the subtle physiological functionings of the body. And certainly, with our dissecting scalpels and so on, we never find something called a channel or chakra, or wind energy. From my point of view, having studied a little bit of anatomy and so on, I see no problem with equating the presentation of the channels and chakras with our nervous system, our central nervous system, our peripheral nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, the various, descriptions of the neuronal complex which pervades the whole body and is associated with the physiological functioning of the body. Also, interestingly, at the sites of where the supposed chakras are located, there are glands which we call endocrine glands, which secrete hormones which have a profound effect on mental experience. So, without following this up in any more detail, I just rest comfortably in the conviction that if I meditate according to the system of channels and chakras, I will experience the result, the desired result. And that's the whole point of meditating. And for sure, there is a strong relationship with the nervous system and the endocrine system, the whole physiological functioning of the body associated with meditating at different points. I remember as a medical student, we were never taught anything about hypnosis. But I remember, and so my view was totally materialistic, as a good medical student should be. And I remember hearing about a hypnotic, I know you call it experiment, but if you can put somebody under hypnosis and you can just tell them, like you can touch the back of the hand, and while they're under hypnosis, you can say, "This is a burning cigarette." After a short time, a blister will appear on the back of the hand where you told the person there was a burning cigarette. Pure mental suggestion, but a physiological response. And that blew my mind as a medical student. This is impossible, according to my view of anatomy and physiology. There is something here which goes beyond what they're teaching me at university. What is it? But it's not, doesn't it, don't go into it. It is too challenging for the scientific paradigms. Yesterday there was also something. I get a little bit bored sometimes up in my room, especially over the New Year period, nothing happening. So I was watching a YouTube thing made in America, and it was a story of how some people, a person, he had a lottery ticket which the numbers came up, he'd won $12 million. But he didn't know, and he went to a shop where they put it through the machine to check, and they said, "No, sorry, you didn't win." So he forgot about it. Then, after a few weeks, somebody rang up the lottery company and said they had the winning ticket. And so that they went, took it into the lottery. And the lottery company was very suspicious about the story that this person presented the ticket. There were a lot of incorrect things in her story, and she changed it and she lied. And it turned out that her brother and father owned a shop which among other things, sold lottery tickets and checked winning tickets or not. And so it took the lottery company a year to be really convinced that this was a valid ticket, and this was the owner. But they had no way of disproving it, and they paid the money. But very hesitantly, but they could not say she wasn't. Anyway, there's a video, a long story, that somebody developed an algorithm where they could tell the habits of people who bought lottery tickets. And they worked out, they didn't know who had bought the winning ticket. They were convinced that this woman, and particularly her family, her brother, did not own it. But they were able to see patterns of lottery ticket buying. And so they, on the computer, they were able to establish a real pattern of the type of person, where they lived, where they bought tickets, etc. Amazing. Anyway, several years passed, and it was advertised in the papers that does anybody buy this ticket? And 600 or 700 people rang up and said, it's my ticket. But none of those people fitted the results of the what they knew. Then there's this one guy, his sister was dying of cancer. And she was in hospital, and she only had a few days to live, and she's going in and out of awareness, sometimes lucid, sometimes asleep. And he, 2 days before she died, or 3 days, he went to see her, and she suddenly sat up in bed, and she said to him, that lottery money is yours. Check the ticket. And he sort of, then she went asleep. The next day, she did the same thing. That lottery money is yours. Check it. And the third day, she died. So the next week, he felt obliged, so he rang up and said, look, my name's so-and-so. That might have been my ticket. Anyway, so the film goes on, the whole story about they realize he was the winner and he had bought the ticket with 5 of his friends and they all shared the money and very happy. And the film concentrated upon this remarkable computer program that could tell who buys tickets. But they did not mention his sister who sat up in bed and said, that money is yours. I mean, it was screaming, why don't you check this? Why don't you talk about this? In this? But it was such, it just did not fit their view of the world. And in the film, they ignored it. To me, yeah, okay, the guy got his deserved money or the guy's, but how did that, his sister, know? And how was she so, in her, as she was approaching death, what made her know and tell him and insist that he gets a look, the ticket checked up? I don't know. But I tell that story because of our tendency to completely blind ourselves to things that occur which are outside the perimeter of our field of knowledge. We reject, we ignore them, we pay no attention. They don't fit, they're too challenging. There are a lot of examples in science. So many examples. So many scientific advances from Einstein back through history where ideas have been presented have been ridiculed, absurd. No, no way. The earth is round. The earth goes round the sun. The sun doesn't go round the earth. I mean, people were murdered, or not murdered, they were killed for having such a heretical belief. Anyway, look, this is just an attempt to say that in investigating karma, investigate these subtle winds and energy channels, at least we must be open-minded and get some more information. And that's coming, hopefully. Okay. Now, we learned in the weekend seminar on death that when we die, the wind energies, which have been supporting all the types of consciousness, flowing through channels around the sense organs, nervous system, then during the day, these wind energies are more very active when we're alert. As we become sleepy, they tend to contract towards what's described as the central channel. So as we cycle between wakefulness and sleepiness during the day, these wind energies become coarse and active, or more subtle and less active. Then when we go to sleep, they contract much more towards the central, what described as the central channel, and the senses stop functioning and we have the experience of sleep. Then during sleep, there's more active times when we're dreaming, less active times when we're in deep sleep. Then we wake up and it all happens again. Death is just the situation where, due to various reasons, the winds contract inwardly, and they, just like when we go to sleep, but then they continues and the winds enter the central channel from above and below, and the mind loses all of the sense consciousnesses, then all of the thinking, and all that remains is the mental consciousness, which is experiencing these subtle visions of death, the white vision, red vision, black vision, clear light vision, the final vision of death. So this occurs sometime, even after we stop breathing. So during that time, the coarse winds with their associated coarse consciousness have stopped functioning. And the term they use, like absorb, they absorb, becoming more and more subtle. And finally, at the center of the heart chakra, there is the most subtle wind and the most subtle mind. This is called the clear light wind and the clear light mind. The mental experience is said to be like clear light. And we all experience it when we die, but it is so subtle that we're not aware that we're experiencing, like there's subtle awareness, but there's no cognitive understanding that this is happening, unless we're a skilled meditator. As we talked during the presentation of death, there are many stages of the death process, and the third stage is when our mind begins to lose our capacity to discriminate between this and that, between right and wrong, virtue and non-virtue. There is less and less power of recognition of what I am, what life is, what is happening in life, and so on. But there is some. It's at that stage of death that it's said that the karmic potency for the future life ripens. So remember, potencies established by different actions, then one of the results is a rebirth result. Rebirth as a human, as an animal, a hungry ghost, or a hell being, or as a divine being, a deva, or in many levels of the divine types of rebirth. Six main levels of rebirth. So, karma for a rebirth, of the type of rebirth, will ripen, and then the mind becomes more and more subtle, going down to the clear light. Then, at the point of death, the most subtle wind with its most subtle mind, right, this one entity, separates from the body. So that is the moment of death. And immediately, due to that ripened karma, the winds become more coarse, but still at a subtle level. And we have a dreamlike bardo body or intermediate state body. The primary cause for this body is the subtle wind, which is becoming, you know, more coarse, but not a gross body, atoms and molecules. And the secondary condition for that bardo body is the mind, the subtle mind. So the clear light mind gives rise to the type of body. The body will be in the aspect of the future rebirth. If human karma had ripened, be human, this intermediate being will look like a human being, said to be very small, like a size of a six-year-old child. It's going to be karma to be an animal had ripened, will be the shape of the type of animal, or a hungry ghost, or a hell being, whatever, a deva. It will be in the aspect of that particular rebirth. So that is determined by the mind. Then, like in a dream, we experience total, everything we experience is coming from our own mind. In the bardo, it's not like a realm where you can meet other bardo beings, shake their hands or whatever. It is your own dream. But it's more than a dream. It is a bardo, intermediate state. But you can experience weird things, pleasant things, unpleasant things, like in dreams, according to your karma. Eventually, you'll be attracted to the situation where your karma will lead to rebirth, and so you'll be reborn. It's said, if your karma to be reborn as an animal had ripened, then, for example, you might feel threatened, pursued, and you'll see a tree with holes in the roots, and you just feel this impulse to dive into that shelter of the hole and be protected. So you have this uncontrolled impulse to go there. And that impulse takes you into the womb of some animal that's going to be your future mother. If you're going to be human, then you have human-type bardo experience as a result of karma. You may see your future parents in the act of conceiving a baby, and you may be attracted towards that conception, or you may have the vision of a beautiful house, and because a human rebirth is much more pleasant than an animal, you can enter that house with, you know, joy. Okay, that's the end of the bardo, and you're conceived as a human. So there's different types of experiences. The point is that you will feel either attraction or to some place which will actually be entering the womb or of a future mother, or you'll feel aversion trying to run away from something scary. But the bardo existence ends, the mind goes down to the clear light, and then once the mind enters the fertilized egg of the future life, then you have this most subtle wind, most subtle mind, the clear light mind, and then because of that karma, we, for example, we had human karma, so a human type, a human aspect consciousness emerges with the coarsening of the winds, and this causes the development of the embryo in the mother's womb. Now, if we look at humans, each human has there's a whole spectrum of personality types. You know, in general, we're all fundamentally very similar. We like the same things, we dislike other things, and we do human things, we act like humans. This is a karmic, also a karmic, to be human is a karmic result. And to have a human psychology, a fundamental human attitude and psychology is karma. And there is a spectrum. Some humans are quite animal-like in the way they relate to the world and the sort of things they do and like. So some humans seem to lean towards an animal-type psychology. Others can be more martial, more aggressive, more associated with violence and aggression to get what they want. This is something like the Asura, you know, the one of the sub-divine or not human, not God rebirths, they call the Asuras, who's just, they're just warlike in their attitude, and they'll, through aggression, they'll go for what they want. Other humans may be more celestial, divine in their attitude, more like the higher gods, but they're all humans. So there's a whole spectrum of human psychology. This is karmic. So it's not just one single karma, it's a whole collection of karmic tendencies from past lives manifesting now in our present human life. I remember, like, years and years ago, there was a student came to Kopan Monastery in Nepal, and this was a lady, she was a university graduate, she was a part-time model, and like really, successful. She told me all her life, since she was a little girl, she had seen ghosts, like visions. And I got her to give me a drawing, which, but sort of flame-like, ethereal things. And she'd see them, and she'd studied psychology at the university. Like, she knew it was pretty weird, and she didn't tell too many people about it because they would dismiss her idea. But she couldn't help. There they were. And she went to see Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and she told the story. And Rinpoche said afterwards, I was talking about her, and Lama Zopa Rinpoche said, she has a karmic affinity for the hungry ghost realm, for the spirit realm. So I thought that really interesting. I didn't question what he meant by karmic affinity. But I thought, yeah, it must be that she's human, she's got a human mind, intelligent human mind, but there is some affinity which enabled her to be aware of the hungry ghosts. I mean, I thought a lot about this. When I was very young, I used to wonder, why is society divided into right-wing politicians and left-wing politicians? Why are people, apparently, from a young age, psychologically, right-wing oriented or left-wing oriented? It was such a puzzle. And sure, there are educational, perhaps, reasons and social reasons in our upbringing. But this division was so strong. And I remember even at school checking up on my friends and seeing tendencies for right-wing attitudes and left-wing attitudes. I felt inclined more left-wing, social-oriented. But so many of the right-wing attitudes are so much the same. Why do all the right-wing politicians, why are they all climate deniers? You know, why are they all so aggressive? Why are they so materialistic? Anyway, when I heard about the various types of rebirth and the karmic tendency, this is interesting. There's much more to our psyche than we really understand. And in the very early days, when I first met Buddhism, I didn't believe in karma and reincarnation. Certainly not the different realms of rebirth. But I thought, wow, this is so interesting, because there are analogies in human psychology, where you can see the whole spectrum from hells, hungry ghosts, animals, humans, divine beings. The whole spectrum is manifest in human psyche. Okay. Karma. Remember, during the weekend on karma, so that the one's karmic gender is determined as we're dying in our previous life, which means we have a psychological gender, male or female, determined by karma in the bardo. Already in the bardo, we will be a masculine or feminine form, result of karma. I remember I said that, okay, psychologically, we can have this tendency to be masculine or feminine, but whether the mind enters an ovum, which has been fertilized by a sperm with a Y chromosome or an X chromosome, maybe that's not karma. Maybe that is chance. So, it's quite possible that a person can be born with a psychological gender of male or female, but a physical gender of the opposite gender. Now, because we've had every type of rebirth in the past, we've been male and female, you know, in every different way, mostly, we sort of, probably, individuals adapt to their physical gender and get along with it, and live a little bit of the opposite gender, and some find it very difficult to adapt because very strong difference between the psychological gender and the physical gender. The physical gender is like that's set by the genes. The psychological gender is not set. It's not like 100% black and white. It's flexible. And I think many individuals, and we all feel different attractions and repulsions to different others and different situations in life. We have a whole spectrum. So, how an individual resolves his or her conflict? Well, there are many different ways, but we should be very open to individuals who have such a conflict and trying to resolve it, and not discriminate against them. Not they'll say, "Oh, yeah, this is life. You know, this happens," and help. Just mainly is to help people not feel wrong. There's something bad about me. I'm not normal, and you know, have this terrible entrapment in an inferiority feeling, negative feeling, which can lead to suicide. It's so sad because social exclusion. Socially, we're like that, aren't we? We tend to associate with people who have a similar psychological attitude to ourselves. You vote for the Conservative Party, you don't like to hang around with people who vote for the Labour Party. If you vote for the Labour Party, you don't hang around with people who vote for the Conservative Party. You know, in general, we are very narrow-minded. We only like to be with people like ourselves. When we think about karma, we should be much more open to the great spectrum of potentialities. Okay. One point about this clear light mind and the emerging as an animal or human or whatever. In the texts, you often read that the clear light mind, this most subtle mind of death, is the source of both samsara and nirvana. What does that mean? Samsara and nirvana surely are opposites. Samsara is existence under the control of ignorance, disturbing emotions, and karma. Nirvana is liberation from the jail of samsara. be completely different. What does it mean that the clear light mind is the source? So, as I've already hinted, when our ordinary mind, now I'm not talking about a bodhisattva's mind or a Buddha's mind, our ordinary mind is in the clear light state, that most subtle mind bears countless karmic potencies from past lives. It bears all of the imprints of our positive mental qualities and our negative qualities. Imprints in as much as they're not manifest, but we have the seed of anger, the seed of love, the seed of greed, the seed of generosity, and so on, are all contained in the clear light mind. So all these potentials. Because of karma, having ripened as we died, then in the next life, the type of rebirth, like animal, human, ghost, whatever, is determined, and the psychology is determined. And all of those karmic potentials give rise to the next life, as well as the psychology, the flexible psychology of the person of the next life. So the whole samsara indeed does emerge from the clear light mind, because that clear light mind carried all of the causes of samsara, karma and disturbing emotions. Nirvana, from the Mahayana point presentation, is not an absence, not a cessation of existence. Nirvana is a blissful state of absorption. And we talk about the supreme nirvana of Buddhahood, enlightenment. So the path to Buddhahood involves progressive elimination, total cessation of all of those karmic potencies created by ignorance, of all of those seeds of disturbing emotions, total extinction of them. But that does not extinguish the mind. Those karmas and disturbing emotions are extinguished by accumulation of wisdom. Wisdom seeing reality in the mind. And the other leg of the path to enlightenment, or the wing of the bird, is great compassion, universal responsibility, a vast accumulation of positive energy, of merit, with a mind focused upon Buddhahood. So there is, let's say, you know, one achieves enlightenment in the clear light state, which one does, but that's another story. There are no karmic potencies, no disturbing emotions at all to influence the continuum of that mind. What is there is the wisdom and the accumulation of positive energy or merit or virtue through bodhicitta, through universal love and compassion. What is the meaning of bodhicitta? Is the intention to become a Buddha in order to guide all sentient beings out of suffering. So that potential, clear light state, instead of from the clear light arising in a samsaric body, from the clear light you arise as the Dharmakaya, the Rupakaya, the wisdom body, the form body of a Buddha. So that is the sense of saying that the clear light mind is the source of both samsara and nirvana including enlightenment. Do you understand? They're not the same. I've read recently some Westerner writing about Buddhism and saying nirvana and samsara are the same. Therefore, we don't have to renounce ordinary life. I mean, unbelievable. So wrong. Such a huge mistake. because the words samsara and nirvana arise from the pure light doesn't mean that they're the same thing. So don't fall into that trap. Okay. So that's what I wanted to talk about this morning. After lunch, I want to talk about, I want to refer to a teaching by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, talking about these important points. So what we've done now, we've established a foundation. Now if we go through His Holiness's explanation of what I've just explained, hopefully it will be easier to comprehend. So that's what we'll do after lunch. So thank you. We'll see you then.